Welcome to In the Studio, the stars and their stories behind history's greatest rock albums. I'm Red Beard, and today in the studio, it's the Cinderella story behind one of the most popular, most influential rock albums of the 80s.
Shout to the heart, and you're to blame, darling, you give love a bad name.
Bang, you know, a shout through the heart, and you're to blame. I mean, you give love a bad name. As soon as that needle hit that record in 1986, our lives changed. And we toured the world and we played with band. Here we are, a bunch of kids singing, "Oi, she's a little runaway." And we're playing in front of like Judas Priest and the Scorpions, and people are chucking things at us. You know, I mean, it was pretty insane. I mean, Tico had to wear like a Yankees batting helmet, you know, in places and stuff. It was nasty, but we learned a lot, you know, and we became a real tight unit. But I think that, you know, I mean, John and I had a writing chemistry at that point, but I don't think we really wrote any great songs until Slippery, and that was really when it came through. Hi, this is Richie Sambora in the studio.
Hi, this is John Bon Jovi of Bon Jovi, and you are in the studio for the 20th anniversary celebration of Slippery When Wet.
Right after the 1986 release of the third Bon Jovi album called Slippery When Wet, lead singer-songwriter John Bon Jovi told me this, and I quote, "Where I lived in Sayreville, New Jersey, it was almost life or death situation. It was either go to work in the DuPont paint factory, join the Navy, or go to Middlesex County College. But all my friends played in bands, so there was that choice you had to make. And when you did, it became either a hobby for fun, or you kept going to see what you could get," end quote. And 120 million fans later, John Bon Jovi has never stopped going to see what he could get. And the ignition point for this rocket ride of superstardom was the album Slippery When Wet. Here's John Bon Jovi with me in the studio.
We were writing quite a bit throughout the Fahrenheit tour and what was to lead up to the Slippery recording. There was no shortage of songs. That much I remember, that whole period of 86 right through New Jersey. And actually, come to think of it, every record, we write a lot of stuff. I had to find subject matter that was going to move the audiences I most preferred to play for. Case in point, You Give Love a Bad Name versus Only Lonely on the second record. You know, I'd broken up with what is now my wife. I was, you know, in the misery, and you know, the teenage angst was now gone. I was in my young 20s, but the girl of my high school dreams had left me, and blah blah blah. I really didn't have much to talk about, but what I did have to talk about hurt me deeply.
Shut
The first number one single from Slippery When Wet. It remained atop the chart for 8 consecutive weeks. For all these years, I've wondered about the line, shot through the heart, in the chorus of Bon Jovi's You Give Love a Bad Name, and whether John Bon Jovi borrowed from a title that he actually wrote on the first album.
Yes. Yes.
Yep.
Yes. Yep.
You know, Steve Miller.
I did. I'm guilty.
Well, yes. Steve Miller said, if you're going to steal, you might as well steal from yourself.
Yes, right. You know, isn't that the truth? Or the other great quote was, a good writer copies and a great writer steals. And I am certainly guilty in that instance of nicking one right from myself. But the line just needed to be there, no matter how hard I tried to work around it. You just said, God darn it, you got to go with that, you know, and and it's okay because not as many people heard the first record as they did that third one, and bang, you know, a shot through the heart and you're to blame. I mean, You Give Love a Bad Name. As soon as that needle hit that record in 1986, our lives changed.
The band Bon Jovi's 1984 debut contained the minor hit Runaway, and the follow-up album 7800 Fahrenheit in 1985 sold enough to earn a Gold Award. But even before that, a relatively young and inexperienced John Bon Jovi from Sayreville, New Jersey, had parlayed New York City radio airplay of his demo into a record deal. Now he needed a band. So he drafted boyhood friend David Brian Rashbaum, veteran Frankie and the Knockouts drummer Tico Torres, and bass player Alec John Such from club act Phantom's Opera. Surprisingly, one of the mainstays of the live music scene, guitarist Richie Sambora, was nowhere to be found.
It's funny, I got this call to come out to Los Angeles to join a band called Kiss, to audition for a band, Kiss, you know? And I was a guy that never left a stone unturned when it came to the music business. Anytime there was a gig or something, I'd go try. You know, whether it was, I don't care if it was classical music, I'd show up for a session, I don't care.
Really?
I'd give it a shot, yeah, I don't care.
Yeah.
So I left, and then when I left, I ended up staying out there. I didn't get the gig, of course, with Kiss. And I didn't think I really, really wanted it anyway. It just wasn't my style of music. Nothing against those guys. That just wasn't my cup of tea. So I come back about a month later. Alex calls me up and says, hey, man, you should come see. I'm playing with this, you know, John Bon Jovi band, and you should come see us. And I said, cool, I just got into town. Let me get back into circulation. And I went to see the band, and I thought they were very good, and I thought that Johnny had a lot of charisma, but I thought they were missing one thing, a guitar player. So I said, you know, introduce me and let's see what happens. So I met Johnny. I said, I'm Richie Sambora. I got some songs. I gave him my resume. And he kind of was like, yeah. Sure. I went, how would you? All right, good. Give me a drink. Let me get out of here. You know what I mean? But Tico was in the band.
Already?
Alec was playing bass.
Already?
And Dave was, you know, doing his thing. And I had known Tico from many of the session dates that we'd run into each other. Like, I'd play, like, milk commercials and stuff like that.
Sure.
So I'd run into him. And so I had a lot of respect for him. So about a week later, I guess the guy said, hey, man, you know, he knows what he's doing. He's not like a kid, you know. I mean, he's a professional already. And I guess I was 23, almost 24. And so I got a call to come down and do a rehearsal. And I got there first before John, and the band was there. And I had the band so tight in about 10 minutes. He walked in. I said, well, so what are we doing? And I had these like 2-3 songs down, like, and the band was just popping. He walked in and went, yeah, I get it now. All right, let's go to work. And that was it, basically.
When did you find out that you could write with John and that the two of you collaborating seemed to be stronger than either one of you alone?
I don't think it was on the first two albums for me, but quite frankly, I didn't enjoy either one of those records personally. I was in a much more mature state in my career, I think, than that particular record, and I wasn't even sure if the band was going to survive. I mean, there's some bright spots, but I don't think we reached the soul of it. Probably not until Slippery When Wet. That's when I really thought that we probably hit it. John was a little bit closed. I think it took a couple of tours to see, that these guys were going to stick by him and stuff like that, and things like that. And, quite frankly, after 7800 Degrees Fahrenheit, I was saying, man, jeez, I wasn't happy with the records we were making. But a lot of other people were, and we toured them so diligently that it was old-time hockey. I think we shoved them down everybody's throat.
You know what? It was old-time hockey.
It was old-time hockey.
That's it really was.
That's really what it was. And we toured the world, and we played with band. Here we are, a bunch of kids singing, Oi, She's a Little Runaway. And we're playing in front of, like, Judas Priest and the Scorpions, and people are chucking things at us, you know what I mean? It was pretty insane. I mean, Tico had to wear, like, a Yankees batting helmet, you know, in places and stuff. It was nasty, but we learned a lot, you know, and we became a real tight unit. But I think that, John and I had a writing chemistry at that point, but I don't think we really wrote any great songs until Slippery, and that was really when it came through.
In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with John Bon Jovi and Richie Sambora in the studio for the anniversary of the blockbuster Slippery When Wet.
Hi, this is John Bon Jovi of Bon Jovi.
Hi, this is Richie Sambora in the studio.
And you are in the studio for the anniversary celebration of Slippery When Wet.
Thanks, gentlemen. I'm Redbeard. For their third album, John Bon Jovi had called Loverboy's Paul Dean to inquire on their producer and engineer, Canadians Bruce Fairbairn and Bob Rock.
Fairbairn's widescreen approach to the band served them particularly well on two cinematic songs, Living on a Prayer and Wanted Dead or Alive. Here's John Bon Jovi with me in the studio.
All of 84 with the first record and all of 85 was spent living out of a suitcase on a bus, traveling anywhere with anyone who would have us play with them. If it wasn't on our own little club or theater shows, we were out opening for the Scorpions or for Rat or for Kiss or for anybody who would take us. So I was on this bus in the middle of the country, a little out of my element, but nonetheless rolling down some endless highway. And I was up at dawn just staring out the window and trying to figure out why I wasn't feeling what I needed to be feeling, really, which was, I came from growing up listening to the Giles Band and listening to Southside Johnny. And, you know, it was a R&B regional, successful kind of localized music, if you will, that had nothing to do with what was becoming very popular out of Los Angeles or the bands that we were opening for. I had very little in common with any of them. I was up at dawn staring out this bus window, and the idea just hit me that, you know, it was going to be my road song. It was going to be Turn the Page. It was going to be that kind of this is my story now. And no matter what, they were just, you know, they're pushing you along, making you do something to go out there and get your name known, get to build a reputation, son, you know, go and get your chops, go and pay your dues. And so, you know, I just sat there and strummed away. And the day that we sat down to write it, we were home. We were in the basement of Richie's mother's house in Woodbridge, New Jersey. And I woke Rich up. And, you know, about 1 p.m. when the sun was warm, we'd get together and sit in that basement and knock one out before dinner. And that was one of those good days where we wrote that and another one. And it was done start to finish in an afternoon because God knows that the emotion was there for it.
It's all the same, only the name.
there's a song, Living on a Prayer, co-written by John Bon Jovi, Richie Sambora, and song doctor Desmond Child, that became the second number one hit from Slippery When Wet, which propelled the album to a total of 15 weeks at number one. Yet, John Bon Jovi has a confession to make about Living on a Prayer.
I could tell you that I didn't think much of it. It was so different than anything we had done before, and with the key change and what was to become the bass line, that when we wrote it, and I remember Richie wasn't feeling well, we wrote it in New York City.
Co-writer Richie Sambora's recollection of writing the song Living on a Prayer is vivid, vividly bad.
I got very, very drunk on Jack Daniels. and then I just remembered, I said, oh man, I'm expected in New York City tomorrow at like 10 a.m. over at Desmond's apartment to do this thing. And I sat down at the piano and I was very drunk. And I had that chord change that was, going from the C to the D and the E minor. And I just held a E note over it. And I just had this one word in my mind called prayer because I was, I didn't know what I was going to do. I wanted to show up with something with these guys. So anyway, I got there very late. There was an extreme amount of traffic. I was throwing up in a Lincoln tunnel, turning green. Then I couldn't find a parking place. I had to walk in the rain to the house, and they had already been starting something else, and I didn't look good. Let's face it, when I walked in. And they were writing something that I particularly just was, I just went, man, that's not happening. You know, this just wasn't happening. I said, look, I got this idea. I said, look, I got one word, prayer. And then these chord changes. And
what did you play it on? What did you play it for?
It was a piano, just a regular piano over in Desmond. He had this real songwriting loft kind of thing. It just kind of started there, and then we all jumped in. And at the end of the day, we had the first verse and B section in the chorus. And I just, man, John and I got in the cab after that, going back to my car from Desmond's. And I go, you know, John, this is going to be a big song. He goes, nah, we're going to give it to some movie soundtrack. He just wasn't connected to it yet. And then when we finished it, he realized that it was going to be a big one for us. And of course, that was I think it's probably one of the best songs that we've written as a band.
We'll be right back.
One of the best rock songs of the last quarter century, brilliantly produced by the late Bruce Fairbairn. That's Bon Jovi's Living on a Prayer from the 1986 third album, Slippery When Wet. Here's John Bon Jovi.
These two kids had given up everything to be in love and to pursue what they hoped was going to be a future together. And be it what may, you know, they were ready to commit. And at that age, and with the future that looked rather bright, that was very brave of them. I'm happy to say that, you know, though not all of the road was smooth, they're still married.
Are you telling me that the characters in Living on a Prayer are based on real people?
Yeah, yeah. Their names were changed to protect the innocent. But, yeah, there was a young couple that I knew that was struggling because, you know, I guess I could tell the story now, and not that it is anything to be embarrassed by, but she got pregnant very early. They were both in school, and they had great aspirations to do other things in their lives. And, you know, he, especially his parents, you know, who struggled so hard to put him in this school, he had to walk away from all of it and go and get a job that it wasn't necessarily what he'd looked forward to doing with his life. And compromises were made. But I gave him such respect because of what they had, you know, set out to do and did, and have subsequently raised two very healthy and happy kids. And yeah, but they were the role models for what the characters became.
Do they realize?
Oh, sure,
that?
Trust me, they know. Yeah, every year whenever we're gonna, and 20 tickets for, and I need 30 tickets for. Okay.
Well, at least it's not the publishing.
No, it's not the publishing. But no, true. Yes, and I've given them credit for it many times.
Coming up next, why your copy of Slippery When Wet probably does not have a pink cover, and if it does, why it's worth a bundle. Be sure to follow In the Studio on Facebook. And hear more rockstar interviews at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with John Bon Jovi and Richie Sambora in the studio for the anniversary of the 28 million seller
Slippery When Wet. Hi, this is John Bon Jovi of Bon Jovi.
Hi, this is Richie Sambora in the studio.
And you are in the studio for the anniversary celebration of Slippery When Wet.
Thank you again, guys. I'm Redbeard with the backstory behind an estimated 28 million copies sold worldwide of Bon Jovi's Slippery When Wet.
I was becoming very aware that I was able to move a stadium. I knew how to find the person in the back row and let them believe that I was looking right at them, which I was doing my best to make sure that I was, and contacting and having contact with them. So if it was the innocence of youth that made you write a song like, you know, something as simple as Raise Your Hand, at least there was interaction between me and that audience. And I knew how to work that thing. You know, it was just something that I was quite comfortable doing. There's everybody finds their niche, and those who survive and those who make any kind of mark in our business find something that is definitively theirs. And there have been some great examples of, you know, Stevie Ray was always going to be Stevie Ray. You know, that you just knew every time you heard that Stratocaster that was Stevie. Or when Hendrix played, you just knew that was Hendrix playing a guitar. When you saw Bruce as a performer or Bono as a performer, you knew the kind of power that they had. I knew how to work that audience and work them up. And that probably came from a wide array of influences, but nonetheless, it was different than the genre of music I was participating in. So when you wrote those kind of songs and you added the big hook, it became our genre. It became our personal little niche.
Yeah.
So what's the only Diamond Award-winning album for sales in excess of 10 million copies in the U.S., which sports a hefty trash bag for an album cover? And why? For the answer, here's John Bon Jovi with me in the studio.
So we went down to a bar that we would frequent, and those bars were, you know, they were go-go bars. And Vancouver's go-go bars were, you know, pretty forward-thinking at the time.
World-class.
And women, they were world-class. And see how political I'm being the way I'm saying this, but they would shower, and they were totally nude. And in these three-song sets, each of these women would shower. And after a few cocktails, the joke was, boy, but that's Slippery and Slippery When Wet came up. And so we thought, what an interesting cover. Obviously, the woman couldn't be nude, but if this beautiful girl was had her picture taken in a soapy shower and wrote Slippery When Wet on the glass. And the photographer took the picture, and obviously we weren't there. And the art director at the label art directed the picture and cropped the shot. And now remember, this is in an era before fax machines, let alone internet. And we were 3,000 plus miles away in Vancouver, not in New York City. And all you saw was this girl from her lips down to her navel and the t-shirt saying Slippery When Wet. He didn't write it on the glass. It's not soapy enough. I'm not crazy about it. Well, we got home and we had turned the master in. And I saw the artwork that was being printed up, and it was the day that this was going to print. The album cover was hot pink, and I had just, you know, and we, as a rock and roll community, had just witnessed what hot pink did to a certain artist during a video, and I'll never forget who that artist was, and I thought, pink, you know, why pink? And the art director said, it matched her nail polish. And I went over my dead body. So we went in to see the CEO, president of the label at the time, who says, but I've printed up 500,000 album jackets. And we said, this will be the demise of the band. You like the record. We like the record. Please don't do this. He said, if you don't turn in artwork tonight, we have to delay the release of the record. And the single is already out. Now, what are you going to do? And I went to the same photographer, Mark Weiss, and I shot a garbage bag with a squirt bottle of water. But it looked like the galaxy. It looked like stars. And so I said, wait. Shoot it again with the water. And I wrote with my fingers, Slippery When Wet. And I said, there's your album cover. I said, remember Back in Black? Here's your album cover. Forget it. Just turn it in. The music was more important than the art to me. And boom, there it was. And he burned not all of, but all of the domestic and European copies of the album cover.
That was
the only ones that were out were already released in Japan.
That was my next question, was did any of them ever sneak out into production? And, you know, how rare are those?
Oh, they're very, very, very rare. They were strictly the first run of the Japanese import. But in those days, you know, Japan had a longer lead time. And it squeaked out over there, but that was the only place.
If you could see inside my heart, then you would understand. I never mean to hurt you, baby. I'm not that kind of man. I might not say I'm sorry. Yeah, I might talk tough sometimes, and I might forget. Hanging on the line, yeah.
think Slippery's success changed the way rock and roll was made from there on? How do you think it changed the business?
At that time, you know, I remember seeing somebody say they made, you know, hard rock accessible to women and to the masses. And there's validity in that statement. It was Dee Snider who I saw say that. And he's right, because all of a sudden the guys who were going to see AC/DC and those guys are ZZ or, you know, Scorpions and those kind of bands, suddenly they saw me on TV sing You Give Love a Bad Name to a girl, and bang, zoom, the poster industry's got a big spike. There was a lot of influence in girls' bedrooms. There was pictures of us.
Yes, that's
true. And you know, and it was a number one single. And remember, there wasn't even a category in the Grammys for hard rock.
You're right. You're right.
You know, when it came, when an album called Slippery When Wet came out, that's when the category was created.
That's a good point.
It didn't exist before then. Being on the cover of Rolling Stone and having a number one, you know, or a couple of number one singles on that record, it did make it much more friendly. It put it from being, you know, a rock band that, unless you were a fan of that genre of music, you didn't know if I was from Canada or France or if it was my first then last name. You know, you really had to read Circus magazine to find out who we were. But when Slippery came out, you could see, you know, my name in Time magazine. And that was it most definitely had an impact.
John and I compared the many favorable reviews from those first four albums. Since that time, it seems that critical response has sometimes been inversely proportional to Bon Jovi being one of the most popular bands in the world.
No one cared in the first two records. It was with the third one. And I think it took so many people by surprise that they couldn't be as cruel as they wanted to be, because it was just such a phenomena. It wasn't until the fourth album, New Jersey, that I thought that the fingers were pointing at us. You know, I think it is people music. It's folk music. That old commercial said, it's music for folks. It doesn't make it any better, but it certainly doesn't make it any worse than the most critically acclaimed, you know, band that there might be out there. And I'm a huge fan of a lot of those kinds of bands. But there's a place for all of it. And anyone who plays music, or anyone who's ever really listened to appreciate music, knows that the magic that music brings, I think it's such an influence on all the other art forms, be it painting or writing a book or a play or a screenplay. Or, you know, I just really believe that it has influence on, obviously, dance and on theater as well. So music to me is the heartbeat of what makes people move emotionally. And I've been on the receiving and on the giving end of that.
Have you since made an album as good as or better than Slippery When Wet?
I think so. I think so. The thing that Slippery has on it was naivete and the exuberance of youth. And that's fabulous. I mean, there was nothing else in your life but making that record. There was no families. There was no money. There was no house. There was no anything other than making that record. And that is a beautiful thing. But I think that I've made better albums as a whole, because there's songs on that record that I wouldn't, you know, think about playing live. But on the other hand, Wanted and Prayer and Bad Name and a couple of the others on there, I think hold up very, very well. But every time you make an album, it's the best album you've ever done. Every time you release a track, you think it has a validity there that the last one didn't. Sure, Slippery was a phenomenon. And I'm proud to say it's mine. But I thought Have a Nice Day was, you know, a better record. I thought that Bounce was a better record. But that's probably just because they're more recent.
I said each stone and I hammered each nail. myself.
I said each stone and I hammered each nail. These house is not for sale. Trust, that's what it is, and always was. No wrecking ball could knock it down. This house was built on higher ground.
Bon Jovi, the title song to the album This House Is Not For Sale. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests, original guitarist Richie Sambora, and of course John Bon Jovi. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2016. All rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter, Brunei. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.